February 13th, 2007. Committee, we're going to move our agenda a bit. We have been fortunate in getting Representative McPherson to come right now, and so we're going to take House Bill 2371. Judith, if you'll tell us a little bit about it, and then we'll ask Representative McPherson to come forward. I wanted him to be here today because this was his idea during the interim for this particular bill, and I think he can articulate it better than anyone as to what he had in mind when he brought the bill to the committee. So, Judith.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House Bill 2371, that's right, was a pre-session filed bill from the interim. It requires certain health and child care facilities to adopt emergency plans that provide for the safety of persons receiving services from those facilities when faced with a threat of imminent danger. We have received a no revenue impact statement on the measure. We're waiting on the fiscal. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. For the record, I'm Greg McPherson, State Representative for House District 38, which is Lake Oswego and part of Southwest Portland. House Bill 2371 is an outgrowth, was a bill introduced by the Interim Committee on Emergency Preparedness, which I was privileged to be a member of, and it was the result of kind of an evolving idea that was started out with reports of the experience of Hurricane Katrina victims in the Gulf Coast, which was that there were reportedly in some facilities in which there were dependent populations, children, seniors, people with disabilities, the personnel in those facilities were not looking after in as full a way as may have been desirable or appropriate the people who were within their care. And the initial inquiry was whether there was a sufficiently clear legal obligation on the part of those facilities and the personnel in those facilities to attend to the needs of those vulnerable populations. There was input from given to our committee that indicated that there was probably a sufficiently well-developed legal obligation to provide that service, and so the idea evolved into what you have before you, which is a bill requiring that certain facilities have an emergency plan so that they know what they would do in the event of a natural disaster that put the people, the individuals who were within their care at risk. And I have I've since received some input that suggests that perhaps that's unnecessary, that there already is a planning obligation. And so I think the committee ought to inquire as to what exists under current law and see whether that's sufficient to cover the need. But that's the source of the bill. That's what the concern that it was designed to address is that there may be vulnerable citizens who need to be looked after, and that without advance preparation to look after them, they may be at greater risk in a natural disaster situation.
Thank you so much. Questions for Representative McPherson? Any questions?
Yes. I just want to say thank you for bringing this up during. It's nice to see someone from our former committee, and I appreciate the work you did. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Boone. It was both a privilege and a pleasure to serve on that committee. It was some great people involved in it, and we dug into the issues pretty effectively.
Thanks.
Okay, well, then with that, there are no questions, then I'll excuse myself. Thank you.
All right, very good. Thank you again for coming. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to have anything to say at all about this bill? Dr. Higgins? All right. We have a sign-up sheet. All right. Stacy Warner.
Thank you. Co-Chair Boone, Co-Chair Berger, members of the committee. My name is Stacy Warner. I'm the Assistant Chief Deputy State Fire Marshal, and I have some testimony on this bill.
Okay.
The Office of State Fire Marshal supports the concept of House Bill 2371. However, as the bill is written, as we read it, it would create a duplicate requirement to existing federal and state licensing agency rules. To address these concerns, we've contacted representatives from the Department of Human Services, the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, the Oregon Fire Marshals Association, Area Agencies on Aging, Oregon Healthcare Association, Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and special districts who've agreed to form a stakeholder work group to contribute to this bill. Additionally, we've invited Oregon Emergency Management to participate. The consensus of the group is the bill could better address emergency preparedness, and we'd like to avoid redundant legislation. One of the stakeholder group has expressed that the bill could better fulfill its intent by capturing care facilities and organizations currently not covered by existing rule and statute. As a group, we recognize the intent of House Bill 2371 as critical to the overall preparedness of care facilities. And I recommend we take the time to collect the concerns, the wisdom, and the contributions of this group in its entirety. By doing this, House Bill 2371 could become substantive legislation to improve emergency preparedness and enhance the survivability of some of our most vulnerable citizens. And I respectfully request the opportunity to contribute to this legislation.
Thank you very much. Chief Horner, if it's already covered, mm-hmm. and this would just be redundant, how would we enhance the survivability?
The concern that was brought to us for those classes of care facilities that aren't currently covered under existing statute and rule. There's some hospice facilities, some ambulatory surgical centers, dialysis facilities, some of these kind of that aren't addressed sufficiently under existing statute and rule. So I think the desire for that aspect is to craft statute that would encompass those facilities. The existing requirements for long-term care, nursing homes, hospitals, assisted living, residential care are quite substantial, particularly if they participate in the federal Medicare program, along with complying with state licensing rules. There's also an additional requirement to comply on the federal side. They have an extensive list of requirements that they have to comply with to participate as well.
Senator Johnson, welcome.
I apologize.
That's perfectly all right. We had to change the agenda to accommodate Representative McPherson, who came and presented the bill. And so his intent, as I think that I had talked with you about earlier, was simply to be sure that the vulnerable populations were protected. Chief Warner is here and has some printed testimony that you might take a look at, suggesting quite a large group that would come together and address the emergency preparedness of various groups and so forth. I think that we thought the bill was quite simplistic and did not get so involved. My concern, and I'll say this to the committee, and that is that we really need to try to move our package. And we already have formed one work group. Mm-hmm. And so if each time we get a bill, and we had a small package, actually, we have another work group to go through. On the other hand, I think that we would like to have good legislation if we're going to have legislation. So, Senator Johnson, would you like to make some comments?
I would, Madam Chair, and I apologize to the public and to you for being late. That run down the hall, you're sort of fall prey to everybody that wants to stop you. I appreciate the Chair's willingness to discuss this with me, and we had an opportunity to chat. During the course of that conversation, the question that was posed was, what are we trying to accomplish here? I think all of us watched the television with horror as we saw particularly vulnerable seniors abandoned as the waters were rising. Mm-hmm. It is my observation that no amount of good planning changes people of bad character who would abandon vulnerable folks, whether it's little babies or it's sick elderly people.
When the water came up, they chose themselves over their charges, and they ran. And I don't think any plan can serve as a prophylactic against that kind of bad behavior. So what I was exploring with the chair was, what if you changed the whole dynamic of this and made it quite clear that instead of planning, we were going to rely on very solid sanctions, so that if, as the waters are rising, someone looks at their elderly patients in a hospital or an assisted living or wherever they are, and they know that the act of abandonment in the face of an emergency results in a felony, and that you come after these people after the craven behavior, you don't try to inoculate against it, which I think is a very difficult undertaking. You have massive planning activities that still don't account for bad behavior. And the ultimate thing that we're trying to prevent is a caregiver or a responsible person abandoning a vulnerable person, whether they're old or young, in the face of imminent danger. And I would much rather have the word go forth that there were very severe sanctions for that kind of cowardly behavior, and that you could end up facing a criminal sanction. And we let much of the planning that's in situ sit and not attempt to reinvent the wheel, because in most places I think there is decent planning. Hospitals, I'm looking at Dr. Higginson, hospitals I presume have decent planning. Different agencies look over child care facilities to make sure that they have decent planning. And so rather than starting a planning initiative for the second time, we simply say that it is the will of the Oregon legislature that if you are derelict in your responsibilities and duties, there are severe criminal sanctions as a result of that, and hopefully, knowing that that would be the outcome of cowardly behavior, people would think differently about it.
Would you like to respond, Chief Warner?
Chair Bloom, Chair Berger, Senator Johnson, I don't disagree.
Cool.
All right. Are there questions for the Chief? All right. Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had raised some questions with regard to this bill earlier, and I'm beginning to rethink them now, but I'd like to just share my thoughts, and I would appreciate your comments. As I listen carefully, it appears to me that this effort, be it this bill or the rest of the planning, when we talk about emergency preparedness, the focus here really is on evacuation procedures. And the question that I had raised is, particularly in facilities that cater to the senior population, the kinds of emergent situations that we face most commonly and that we know we will face every year are the sorts of situations where people really need to be cared for in place rather than evacuated. So my concerns were around generation of emergency power and some of those sorts of things that I'm not sure that we fully attend to, but perhaps that's more appropriately placed in a different discussion, since this one. So if you could clarify for me, when we talk about emergency preparedness, are we really focusing this on the evacuation of folks' needs rather than actually how the rest of the scope of what we need to do to care for people in those situations?
Chair Boone, Chair Berger, Representative Callan. When I discuss emergency preparedness issues along these lines, it encompasses that whole spectrum from defend-in-place situations up through and including evacuation of the facility, and then what happens to those folks then. Case in point, a week ago or so, there was a fire in a care facility in Oregon City. Everyone got out fine. A few of them got wet, but nobody was hurt. But then the issue came about is, we've got them out of the building, now what do we do with them? And those plans that they have work to address that. From our standpoint, when we survey these facilities, those are all things we look at, as well as generation of emergency power and those kind of things. We don't like to have to remove them from that environment unless we absolutely have to, but there has to be a process in place to do that, and a safe place to take them where their needs can be met.
Follow up. So do you feel that the plans that are in place, or the planning processes that are in place now, are addressing that whole spectrum?
Chair Boone, Chair Berger, Representative Cowan. Those types of issues are pretty extensively addressed both in federal regulation for those facilities that participate in Medicare and Medicaid program and in existing state licensing rules and the Oregon State Fire Code. There's quite extensive lists of elements that have to be addressed in those plans. And part of what we do in those facilities when we go through there is we look at those and evaluate those.
Thank you. All right, Representative Nelson.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here, Mr. Warner. I was so excited about being a part of this committee because for the past, whatever it is, 6 years, 7 years, you know, I have felt that as a state, we do not address that safety is our top priority. And the proof is that we don't have even designated funding to see that safety is our top priority. So if that doesn't tell the story, and coming from an aviation background, mm-hmm. it's just unbelievable. And Representative Johnson, likewise, I'm sad she left because she would have to agree with me on this one. But if an airline that's flying, you know, around the world, every 6 minutes or something, I can't which is watched every 6 minutes or talked to every 6 minutes or whatever the rules are. If they have a coordinated emergency preparedness plan, I just cannot see why the state of Oregon doesn't. So here's my little thought about this bill is having served on the Senior Transportation Committee in my county, Yamhill County, I just asked the people there, who goes first? You know, if we had a massive flood here, who do we take care of first? Who's on first? You know? And the truth is, we don't have a plan. And I have in my office right now, thanks to a very good staff, every emergency preparedness program from every county in the state, plus three other states, and none of it is coordinated. So I just want to say to the good chairs here and members of this committee, it seems like to me we better start having some extra meetings and workshops or something, because I can't even evacuate Yamhill County, much less 500,000 people come from Portland because they can't get through a Newburgh-Dundee non-bypass. I'm just saying, this is how serious this is. So we can handle, like you say, and y'all have done a wonderful job. In fact, the Dayton fireman saved my life on October 28th, as most people know. But I'm so grateful for the individual mm-hmm. things we do. But as far as to have an overall plan where we connect together, we don't have it, do we?
Co-Chair Boone and Co-Chair Berger, Representative Nelson. To the level I think you're talking about, a fully integrated, coordinated statewide plan of what to do with everybody, I don't know that anybody has that. I think there are agencies within the state that are working in that direction, but as you've discovered, I think through some of the research of your staff, it's a rather large problem to grapple with, and to try and integrate all of the elements of that into a cohesive plan is a monumental task. Not that it can't be achieved over time, and I think, like I said, there are elements of state government out there that are working on that, but it's a rather daunting task, and it'll I don't know if we'll ever get there, but we'll get closer.
Once again, if we took Yamhill County and the five counties that surrounded us, and that's a region that has to work together,
mm-hmm.
I mean, those buses got to move somewhere fast, and everything else. So my point is, why aren't we grasping this plan in regions? In the state, you know, we've got nothing else, four corners, you know, and we're all coming together right here in Salem, and you know, have these individuals that are supposed to, by this law that you handed out, already have these plans. We don't, because we don't even have an emergency management person in Yamhill County. Just there last Friday. So why don't we just start from that point you know, and whether it's Ken Murphy or you or Secretary of State leading, you know, I really don't care. As long as we identify our plan, our transportation, you know, it's a critical issue here. Your medical, the medical needs are critical here, but first, it seems like after we stabilize them, just like LifeLight, you know, we got to move these people somewhere, and we don't even have a plan of where we'd move them. So do you think that's possible, that we could do this?
Coacher Boone, Coacher Berger, Representative Nelson. I think that'd be a worthwhile endeavor to take on. It's not our under our purview per se, but we would certainly bring it up to the folks that we know that would do that and try and get that effort moving.
Thank you. Senator Marsette.
Thank you. I want to go back to Senator Johnson's suggestion, which I like, except that I think it would depend on a plan.
That's
to
right.
Define what a Cowardly Act was, yeah. Because I think a lack of a plan might prompt people to do things that they otherwise wouldn't do. But I do like the sanction part. But on the other hand, I think that the... In fact, I like the bill the way it is, and I think... that to do the training and let people know what they're supposed to do, and then if they don't do it, that adds more weight to the sanction. Because if it's chaos and there is no plan, you know, I think many well-meaning people might panic because they don't know what to do. But I think the sanction part is good.
Representative Shelfer.
Yeah, thanks. If this is redundant language, which I've read federal language, if it is redundant, I don't know why we would do redundancy. That's my first question or comment. On the Oregon City, and the people in New Orleans, some of them folks are going to jail, I believe. Some of them are in jail right now.
Good,
and
good.
So
good, good.
I think we already have some kind of avenue to... And I don't know if I want some candy striper being held liable, some goes to hell in a handbasket. But and as far as safety being a priority, well, you know, we do have a little safety budget here that we're discussing. I don't know if it's a priority or not, but everybody talk about it. You can't talk about safety and staffing, collective bargaining here in the state of Oregon. What is our priority? I don't know. But I don't want to do anything redundant. On the Oregon City... Well, that happened during the day, I think, and the weather was rather nice, and they had full staff on hand. At night, the staff levels go down. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Right, and I just want to follow up, Madam Chair. You know, so, and if we're going to add the sanctions, they're going to want to make sure they're ramped up all the time, ready to go. Well, that means more money, because that's going to mean more staff. So, once again, every time we open our mouth in this building, we spend millions of dollars, and I'm not saying we shouldn't do it, but it's going to be more than this, and I'm not sure this solves any problem that we have right now. That's my opinion. I'll shut up now. Thank you.
One thing that I want to ask you is that in your testimony, you have talked about a whole different group of people that need to form a work group, and that there are facilities and organizations currently not covered and not having a plan.
Sure.
Why would that be? As Chief Fire Marshal, do you have the authority to see to it that they have a plan?
Coacher Boone, Coacher Berger, no, the requirements for those facilities come from the licensing agency themselves. We generally consult with them when they're creating their rules to ensure that the fire and life safety portions that we do have expertise and some authority over are adequately verbalized in their rules. But the specific requirements for the different classes of facilities come from the state licensing agency and in some cases also from the federal government. If they participate in the Medicare Medicaid program, there's a list of requirements that have to be met as a condition of participation. Some of the facilities I'm not fully familiar with as far as what all the requirements are. I've only been working on this for a couple of days. I haven't had a chance to finish going through all the existing rules that I could find to that apply. But in discussion with some of the representatives from those organizations that I have listed, that is some of the what has been relayed to me. Some of their concerns are is that there may be some classes of care facilities that aren't maybe as protected as they would like to see them.
Well, and I'm certainly not holding you responsible, but I don't think the legislature coming up with a bill should trigger that kind of thing. I think that if people are not and don't have a plan, or if they're not under their guidelines, it shouldn't take this legislature talking about a bill to have some action happen on that. Committee, we're under time constraints today. This room is going to be used by another group. We need to be out by 5 o'clock. So with that, Chief Warner, I'm going to ask you to step back, and I'm going to call Rick Bennett to testify on this bill, and that will be our last testimony on this bill. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Because of the time concerns, I'll try to be very brief. In first reading of this bill, I also shared many of your thoughts that this seemed to be very duplicative. I've in a past life been administrator of a nursing facility as well as a inpatient hospice facility and other health care facilities, and I know the type of emergency plan that we had to have in place and have available for surveyors to see and so forth, and to train our employees as well. But I would question, are there other entities that are providing care or providing housing to individuals who may have special needs or be vulnerable, and whether in fact they should be covered in some way as far as having this type of plan in place? Also, I don't know, I think others more knowledgeable in federal regulation could answer this, but another question that came to mind is that how much detail does the federal regulation require as far as what must be a part of the plan, and whether the state can supplement that in any way as far as what our requirements might be. As indicated, most often the thinking is to stay in place in that facility and so forth, but what if you do have to evacuate? Does your plan include not only safe evacuation of your patients or residents, but does it also include the transporting of medical records, emergency medicines and supplies that might be needed? And basically, how are you going to care for those individuals once you've evacuated them to another place? So it's just something else to keep in mind. And the last thing that I wanted to touch on is related to Senator Johnson's comments. I would also agree that, you know, you can have a plan, but really that facility administrator is the one who's responsible for implementing that plan. And I believe facility administrators must be held accountable for properly authorizing and implementing the plan when they're supposed to. Thank you.
All right. Any questions? All right. Thank you very much. Well, committee, I just want to make just a few comments. One is I'm always somehow appalled at the gaps that we find when we start looking at an issue. For instance, I would think if the licensing agencies are doing something, that would be a requirement that they would have, that you could evacuate safely those individuals that are a vulnerable population, whether they're children or adults. So I think that obviously that may not be the case, and so I'm going to close the public hearing today on this, and we're going to move on to another bill, but we're going to be talking about this afterwards as well. Close public hearing on House Bill 2371. I'll go back to the top of the agenda now to the work session, consideration of the revision of the adopted committee rules. Judith?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Yesterday you received in your meeting materials a proposed revised committee rules for this joint committee. The reason that we're reconsidering the rules is the rules that we originally adopted were rules that really the Joint Ways and Means Committee uses. It's not very typical to have a policy joint committee. And so there were some differences, and some members brought forward some concerns regarding minority reports. So I just want to point out the difference in the original adopted rules and the rules for your consideration now. First of all, deleted completely is the concept of number 18 in our original rules, if you happen to have the originals, talks about that before a measure is reported out of committee that introduces a new tax expenditure, it will state the policy of that tax expenditure. Well, policy committees don't move forward with tax expenditure proposals, and so that was deleted from now the new revised rules. Most importantly, number 14 is replaced. Rule number 14 talked about that the measures will be sent to the floor without minority reports. Instead, now we have a new 14, 15, and 16 in the proposed revised rules that reflects language that other policy committees have regarding minority reports, and that is minority reports will be allowed. Those wishing to file a minority report must notify the chair and the committee administrator by 5 o'clock of that session day in which action was taken, or before adjournment of the committee in cases that it goes past 5 o'clock. That minority report will be subscribed to by at least 2 members of from each house, since this is a joint committee. Members shall have 48 hours after giving notice or the second following session day, whichever is earlier, to file that minority report and the legislative council draft, and committee staff is here to help you accomplish that. Number 15 is a bit unusual, so I just want to point it out to you, and that is if a minority report goes to the floor with the committee majority report and it is not adopted, it shall be filed jointly with the committee report in the second chamber and would come back to this committee. So the idea there is, if there is an original minority report out of the joint committee, that minority report and the committee report adopted on the initial chamber floor will come back for full consideration by the joint committee before it moves on to the second chamber. And then number 16 is simply the standard language that once, you know, we're near sine die, that those actions regarding minority report notices and drafting have to take place rather quickly. So those are the primary changes. The other rules are standard and have not changed. Are there any questions regarding the proposed revised committee rules?
All right. Any discussion? Representative Creek.
Madam Chair, I appreciate this being put back in, but and there may be a need for it. I don't know that. But I would suspect with the group that we have here and the co-chairs that we have, that with over a cup of coffee in someone's office, about 90% of what we need to work out will be worked out. And I'm going to avoid that. I'll give you my pledge. If I can avoid it in any way, I'm not going to get involved in any of that.
Me either.
So I want you to know how I feel about you and the members we work with.
Representative Krieger, would you explain that to me?
It would be nice to
you. In other words, I have great faith in you and your chair, co-chair, and everybody here.
I appreciate that. Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, given Representative Krieger's very generous remarks that I think reflect the attitude of many of us, if you're looking for a motion to move ahead with the new rules, I would be happy to offer that motion and move us on with our agenda.
Very fine. Thank you.
I so move.
It has been moved that we accept the revision of the adopted committee rules. Is there any objection? If not, adopted. All right. Next on the agenda will be House Bill 241. Senate Bill, excuse me, 241.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Senate Bill 241 expands membership of the Commercial Fishery Permit Board by 6. three of which would be representatives from developmental fisheries and three from either restricted participation or restricted vessel permit systems. It directs that representatives only participate in board actions related to their respective fishery or system. It allows a person's denied developmental fisheries permits or restricted permit to request review by the Commercial Fishery Permit Board. There is an appeal provision that's added with this measure, and it directs the board to review those initial denials as contested case hearings. And it provides that those that contested case orders are not subject to review by the commission, but instead may be appealed to the Court of Appeals. You have at your seat at the dais the dash one amendments. Those remove a reference, if you look on the bill, page one, lines 8 and 9. There's a deletion to a reference to the State Fish and Wildlife Commission. The effect of that deletion is the fact that appeals then will not go to the commission that has just made a decision regarding a denial. Instead, then, it moves that appeals process to the Commercial Fisheries Permit Board and then on to the Court of Appeals if necessary. We have received a no revenue and no fiscal impact on both the original measure and these dash one amendments. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you very much. I'll call Roy Elliker and Patty Burke.
Good afternoon, Madam Co-Chair.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
Representative Boone. Pleasure to be here again, and the department welcomes the opportunity to bring this bill forward to the Joint Committee. On my left, Dr. Patty Burke, our Marine Program Manager, and I would like to direct your attention to some testimony that's being passed out that I think very succinctly describes what we're looking to achieve in this bill. By way of a backgrounder as well, if after the first page, we do have an overview of our developmental fisheries program. This bill is specifically designed around our developmental fisheries program, which is a very specialized commercial fisheries development program. And Dr. Burke can talk a little bit about that program and some of the changes we'd like. But just in an overview, again, Senate Bill 241 proposes two changes to our developmental fisheries statutes. The legislature established the developmental fisheries program to help develop and provide controlled development and provide encouragement to fishermen to go out, develop new markets, develop new technology, and look to provide new fishing opportunities here off the coast of Oregon. So controlled development is a means to collect sufficient information to understand the effects of this type of new type of fishing as it gets going, determine sustainable harvest levels, and determine how to minimize impacts on other marine resources as it goes forward. We've had a whole lot of species go through this program. They include things like spot prawns, swordfish, box crabs, giant octopus, bay clams, a number of others, sardines, a number of others, some which have developed into very high money fisheries, very important economic fisheries for our coastal area. During 2003 and 2004, the Developmental Fisheries Board conducted a review of the entire Development Fisheries Program, including the rules, the processes, the board membership, the mission, etc., and they made two recommendations to the commission, which are then turned around and became a legislative concept for the agency. Beginning on page two, we line out those two changes, and I'll let Patty Burke go ahead and go through those specific changes we're asking in the bill.
Thanks, Ray, Madam Co-Chair. For the record, I'm Patty Burke from Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife's Marine Program in Newport. And the proposed legislation, a simple way to put it is that it's going to make the review of these limited entry programs the same as all of the other commercial limited entry programs. The developmental fisheries program had been in place, as you could see, for over 10 years, and only in recent years had some of them gone into a controlled limited entry program and we were removed by the commission from the developmental fisheries program. Nearshore species were originally removed by the commission, and then Representative Krieger enacted a limited entry program and statute. We have bay clams and sardines that just this year went into limited entry. Unfortunately, in 93, when this bill was created, there was a glitch in that when the fisheries were removed from limited entry by rule as opposed to by statute, the law was not allowing for the usual review of permit appeals. And so the commission took that on. And this bill will then convert any fisheries to the permit review board's process, which is consistent with all other fisheries. So the two actions are basically to authorize the permit review board to review denials in developmental fisheries permit programs and any future fisheries that are removed from the developmental fisheries program to go through that process, and then to expand the membership of the commercial fisheries board to accommodate the review by two citizens and three people that are participants in that fishery, which is also how we handle the other permit appeals.
Excuse me, just one other thing, Senator. Excuse me, Co-Chair Senator Verger, and Co-Chair Representative Boone. Just by way of some of the, and I know it's easy for us being in the Oregon Fish and Wildlife. Sometimes we refer to jargon. When we talk about limited entry fisheries, what we mean is that a fisheries that is limited to a certain number of total participants or total number of vessels. For instance, crabbing, which is one of the most important economic fisheries on the coast, is limited by statute to, I think, 433 permits. And those permits have value in the fishery. People buy and sell them. They can own more than one of them, I believe. And we also now, either by statute or rule, have a number of limited, what we call limited entry fisheries. Sardines are a good example, as Ms. Burke said in her testimony. Sardines just this year went from the development of fisheries program, where there are certain rules and regulations attached to the fisheries, to its own set of rules as a fishery and a certain number of permits as set by commission in rule. So limited entry fisheries can be established in rule or in law, statute, and in crabbing they're in statute, in sardines they're in rule, but they're all in some way to limit the number of people who go out and fish for these species, to protect their markets, to protect their income, and protect the coastal folks that kind of are part of that local fishing economy.
Questions or Shelford?
Madam Chair, my phone went off. I apologize to you and the committee. I couldn't even hear it. But my question is, one thing I want to make sure we all don't do this, that we develop these fisheries, people go out and invest a bunch of money in it, next thing we know, we're restricting their ability to fish. Now they're stuck there holding a bag. And you know exactly what I'm talking about. We're going to make sure that doesn't happen, right?
is that co-chairs? Do I need to respond? Or
I'm very seriously concerned.
And
about
I think you're under some kind of oath.
Then it's on the record.
Well, co-chairs Boone and Berger and Representative Schaffler, as you are very aware, these issues on a take, at some point, the number of people participating, vessel size, things like that, are all things that go through a commission process. So in the end, many of these are made by the commission after quite a long public process. And particularly, I know the most recent one, which I know some folks don't 100% agree with, the crab pot tiers, in other words, limiting the number of fishermen that fish at what size number of crab pots they can use off their vessel, was after probably a 2 to 4 year public process and a lot of work with the crabbing fleet itself. So in the end, there were some folks that who are in the crab industry. Some would have preferred bigger limits. Some would have preferred smaller. But out of 433, many in the end thought in the end they can live with the results. Anyway, Representative, there's no easy answer to that one, other than I do assure you that the commission and department very much feels the stress or understands that there are folks' livelihood at stake. There are local economies at stake. When you go to Port Orford and look at the fishing fleet there, a small boat fleet,
sure,
all lifted out of the ocean every day. People are very aware of that, Representative. I do want to assure you, both on the agency and the commission, and that things that affect people's livelihood and how they take care of their businesses. I've often heard Dr. Burke or Patty, sometimes, but referred to that in the crabbing industry, for instance, we're talking about 433 individual small businesses, all with different strategies as to how they're going to get on with the world, make money for themselves, support their crewmen, pay life and health insurance, and all that. And that thing, we take that very seriously. I do want to assure the panel of that.
Thank you.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you do have control over conditions in the ocean, too, right?
So we got a bill for that.
Oh, we got a bill.
Other questions? Representative Krieger?
No, it's really a question, Madam Chair, but Roy, emphasis has been is to sustaining the resource, the fishermen and the communities that are dependent on that, and then the industry as a whole. That's really what it's about, in my mind.
Co-Chair, Representative Krieger, I think every one of us in the agency that deals with these issues and from the commission would agree with you on that.
Other questions, comments? All right, we do have a dashboard amendment. I'll entertain the motion.
Madam Chair, the work
session. Open, close the public hearing, open the work session.
Madam Chair, I have moved the dashboard amendments of Senate Bill 241.
Senator George moves the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 241. Any objection?
And Madam Chair, I would recommend that we have to give me the motion on this one, will you? 241 is amended. Okay, we have it. I haven't seen this so far. Great. I move the Senate Bill 241 is amended. We've already gone through that. Let's see. Reported to the floor with the due pass as amended. Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right. All right,
back to you.
Back to me. All right. Is the Senator George moves the Senate Bill 241 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? All right. If not, we'll have the roll call.
Senator George L.
Aye.
Senator Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Senator Morissette.
Aye.
Representative Shawford.
Aye.
Representative Calvin?
Aye.
Senator George
Heaney?
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Chair
Berger? Aye. The motion having received the required majority is declared passed.
We're making progress.
Not much. Going fishing.
We're moving on.
We have to warn her not to get used to it, though.
All right. The next one is House Bill 2080. All right.
Bill crosses went off the other day. He had his rainbow paintball. He was having
a dance.
I'll ask that our committee administrator tell us a little bit about House Bill 2080.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2080 allows the governor by proclamation upon the request from the Secretary of State to extend the deadline for returning ballots in the event of civil disorder, state of emergency, natural disaster, or other catastrophic event. Limits the extension of the deadline to no more than 14 calendar days after the election. Directs the governor to set a deadline for returning ballots, declares an emergency, effective on passage. We have three amendments. The first, the -1 amendment, would reduce the deadline from 14 days to 4. The -2 amendment would use the definition of an emergency currently in statute, which would be found in ORS 401.025 sub 3, and I have a copy of that statute attached. The -3 amendment would prohibit the tally of ballots in all counties in the event of emergency. It does not have a fiscal impact, and it does not have a subsequent referral.
All right. I don't have the sign-up sheet.
There is no one on the sign-up sheet.
All right. I see the Secretary of State's office is here. Would you like to come to the podium? As you know, we had a public hearing on this bill, and now we have three amendments, and so I'll let you give us some testimony and tell us who you are for the record, please. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm John Lindbeck, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's Office. And once again, thank you to the committee for your continued work on what is a very important bill for the voters of Oregon. I had a conversation with Senator George today about these amendments, and we discussed some options to them. In regards to the number of days, we would, of course, go forward with anything that the committee thinks is a fair number of days. My reaction when I saw the amendment reducing from 14 to 4 was harkened back to actually a personal experience I had before Christmas, in which we had what I considered to be sort of a run-of-the-mill storm, really, a big one-night wind, in which my family was out of power for 6 days and out of heat for 7. And it sort of gave me thought, a pause about, we could live with 4, but, maybe 7 would be better. So those are my thoughts. I just thought I'd lay those on the table for you to think about. My initial reaction was that 7 is probably a bit safer than 4. I'd be anxious to hear what your thoughts are about that.
Senator George.
Thank you, Chair. I did have a conversation with the Secretary of State's office that seemed reasonable. I talked to Representative Krieger, who also had the same concerns I did, and I think we, and Representative Krieger can make some comments, but I think we agreed that we would be happy with the dash amendments, maybe come up with some additional amendments to change it from 14 to 7. And I think people would be more, at least Representative Krieger and I would be more comfortable with that. I don't know if Representative Krieger wants to say the same thing, but if the Secretary of State was agreeable to that, we're agreeable to it. I'm agreeable to it.
All right. Thank you for those comments. Senator George, does the dash 3 not cover the dash 1?
It does, and that was a discussion that you and I had. We talk about the dash 3. I think the Secretary of State has some, once these dash 3 amendments came out of legislative council, the Secretary of State's office had some very, very constructive comments on it. And I think the dash 3 amendments are mine, and I was happy with the proposal that Secretary of State will talk about. I think that both of them work, and I think if we changed the dash 1s, if we changed from 14 to 7 rather than 14 to 4, I'd be happy with both changes in the dash 1 and the dash 3 amendments as the Secretary of State's agreed to or generally accepts.
Representative Krieger, any comments on the dash 1s?
Madam Chair, part of our process is compromise, trying to find a middle ground for something that will work for all those people involved and wanting to do that. And the whole issue was, if you're not going to count the ballots and then laying around for 2 weeks, it lends itself to mischief. You might have a bad Republican running around out there somewhere doing things they shouldn't be doing. And so if you want to go to 7, I can go there, but I think 14 was really too much.
Are you not comfortable with the dash 3s replacing the dash 1s?
If I could, Representative Berger.
Senator George.
I hadn't discussed this with Representative Krieger, but one of the things we're talking about is trying to create an environment upon where there would be as little mischief as possible with ballots out there.
Okay.
And so the dash 3 amendments, from my perspective, is to make sure that there's no partisan politics enter in to the ballot counting process. And I think both the dash 1s and the dash 3s will help do that. I think is the dash 3s get us most of the way there, but I think with Representative Krieger, if I'm not mistaken, he's comfortable with the 3s being adopted and the 1s being adopted with some compromise. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So I think that perhaps changing both of them would be constructive to get consensus on the committee, but I'll let the chairs take that how they want.
All right.
The dash 3 amendments, I think, Senator, are the are the ones that get to the guts of the issue. But
right.
both of them together make it, I think, a really solid bill that everybody can support.
All right. Any other comments?
If you'd like me to run through our suggested changes to the Dash 3 amendments, I'd be happy to do that.
Sure.
Be happy
to hear that.
Okay. First of all, I think before I explain them, I ought to sort of give you some context on the way counties are the rules counties live by now with regards to opening of ballots and running ballots through the machines in a regular election where we don't have an emergency situation. Currently, counties under a combination of statute and state law may start opening ballot envelopes 7 days before the election. They can bring their election boards in to start that public pre-inspection of ballots and do all the processing work necessary to get ready to run ballots through tally machines. On election day, they're allowed to start running ballots through the tally machines, but they are not allowed to run a report that tells you what the actual tally is until 8 o'clock, the 8 o'clock deadline hits on election day. My recommendation would be to keep that system intact in this situation. And to do that, it would require a slight wording change in the Dash 3 amendments, in which it would tell the counties that they were not allowed to issue or order a tally report from any vote tally machine until the deadline set by the governor has passed. That would continue to, they could then continue to do that processing and running ballots through the machine, but nobody would know what the results are until that deadline set by the governor has passed. And that would keep the process intact as it is now, and I think allow for people's expectations in regards to as speedy as possible release of results on once that deadline is over.
So are you talking about just the two words, has passed?
No. What,
Governor?
I actually have a section. What I would do is I would delete the words, begin the tally of ballots, and I would replace it with order tally reports from any vote tally machine used to count votes.
Senator George?
Yeah, the Secretary of State's office discussed it with me, and I think it deals with my concerns in this situation, because what I'm really trying to do is I'm concerned about anybody knowing the results prior to somebody else's ballot box being closed. Okay. And so I think the Secretary of State's suggestion to change the amendments is constructive, and I've signed a note to Legislative Council for them to work with Secretary of State's office on the changes to the two amendments. And so I'm happy with the changes that the Secretary of State's office has suggested.
All right.
Senator?
Yes.
I would like to just make a comment, and I'm glad that y'all are working together on this and making this work out. My concern with changing the actual number of the days was that we would find ourselves in a situation where, and let's just make it local, the Quartz Creek Bridge on Highway 26 is out. And that precludes a big section of my county, where I live, from getting their ballots physically unless they airlift them. And what if the road is fixed on the eighth day, for example? So I'm concerned that we, not knowing what we're doing in this kind of thing or what we're up against, would set an arbitrary number of days when I think that if the governor gets to say, you know, it's an emergency, and then once the emergency is over and we're precluded from announcing tally or the number of votes and the results, that would take care of it. And we wouldn't have to deal with days. And I guess I'm not paranoid enough to be thinking in terms of mischief in times like this. I've got more important things to do than figure out how to screw up the elections.
All right, other comments? Senator Johnson.
And respectfully, while Representative Boone is out doing the Lord's work, there are other nefarious low types would be glad that you were out there on the front lines and they'd be there trying to rig the election. I am very uncomfortable with leaving this open-ended.
Other comments? I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2080, and I will ask our administrative assistant to bring the reflected changes in the amendments back for the next meeting. All right, committee, that finishes our bills for the day, and now we're going to hear from the Red Cross. And David?
Gassaway.
Is that right? All right. Welcome, and we're going to hear about what the Red Cross does in times of emergency. If you remember in Katrina, the Red Cross was at the city limits waiting to come into the city and was not allowed to come in by either the governor or the mayor. And so I hope that David can reassure me that when the Red Cross gets ready to come in, they're going to be able to get here.
We just can't get through Newburgh. We won't have it in Newburgh. There will be no emergencies in Newburgh until that bypass is built.
Okay.
That's all right.
That's good.
Madam Chair Boone and Madam Chair Berger and honorable members of the Emergency Preparedness Committee, what I've been asked to do today is give an overview of the Red Cross and then get a little bit more detail about how the Red Cross responded to the recent flooding in primarily northwestern Oregon, as well as what our local response to the Hurricane Katrina challenge was. The Red Cross in Oregon is composed of six chapters, so we cover every square inch of Oregon. I'm based out of the Oregon Trail chapter in Portland, where I serve as the Emergency Services Director. The Red Cross has really two components. We have a massive blood services component, which is administered for Oregon, most of Washington, and most of Idaho through the Pacific Northwest Regional Blood Services. And we supply many of the hospitals and access about 50% of the nation's blood supply through people who come in and donate. We also have quite an active health and safety program. We do a lot of first aid classes, CPR classes for adults, kids. We even have a pet first aid program, as well as an aquatics program. Then
I have to ask.
Yes.
Having been trained extensively on all that, CPR and everything, and babies are the hardest, of course, you're down to two fingers. Which pets? Cats, dogs, birds?
I have not gone through the pet first aid training myself.
Okay.
I understand that it focuses on our four-legged friends, but they actually do have dog mannequins that they work on, so you can practice your mouth to snout.
Mouth to snout, okay, yes. That's what I was going for next, but thank you. My lips touch dog lips.
Do it for my dog.
Madam Chair, may I ask if I could get some help with technical projection up there?
Sure, absolutely. I'm hoping someone can do that for you.
And Madam Chair, while we're waiting, we used to have water that was so bad at the farm that we actually used to suggest that you might, after drinking the water, kiss the dog to get the taste out of your mouth.
Oh.
This training might come in very handy.
For the record.
Yeah.
Agreed.
That was bad. Well, your story was bad. Oh, bad. Okay. Sorry about that.
All right. Are you all set up now?
Well, I believe I'm set up on my end. It's my objective here is to allow you to see my presentation as well.
But it won't project, huh?
It doesn't appear to be projecting at the moment. But to move on,
okay.
We also are very, very active supporting military families. And we do this through a service called Armed Forces Emergency Services. Most of this is based around emergency communications between families of military personnel who reside in Oregon and U.S. military personnel who may be anywhere in the world. An example of this is grandma has gone very ill all of a sudden, and the family wants to bring the service member home on short notice. So the Red Cross will work to validate and verify the claim. We then document this. We send it through Red Cross channels and then military channels. The message ends up with the commanding officer, wherever this military member is stationed, and it's ultimately that commanding officer's decision whether or not to bring someone home. But we have a very, very high success rate in doing this, and the military looks to us as their trusted agent to help them with this verification. We also work very closely with the respective military aid societies to provide emergency assistance to whether they're military members or families of the military. We also are part of a global network of Red Cross and Red Crescent societies, and we do a fair amount of what we refer to as Red Cross message traffic as well as international tracing. An example of this might be a family who resides in Oregon. They recently migrated from the Congo, let's say, and that family has lost touch with their loved ones over in the Congo. So they can come to us, we'll compose a message, pass it through national and international Red Cross channels, and try to track down that family. Each Red Cross chapter has the ability, once they have covered the bases I just covered, as well as disaster services, which I'll get into in a moment, to do some optional services. In the greater Portland area, we partner with a number of other agencies to provide transportation to the elderly when they need transport to critical medical appointments. And if we have any spare capacity, we might take the elderly shopping or to social groups. But our priority is medical transport. And we work very closely with a number of other agencies, including TriMet, to service the people in the greater Portland area. In disaster services, for a disaster, it covers everything from a single-family house fire, which composes about 95% of our activity, all the way up to apartment fires, floods, tornadoes, earthquakes, really the whole gamut of disasters. And we have some primary services that we provide when we do this, no matter what the level. We provide sheltering, and perhaps we're best known for the ability to set up mass shelters in times of need. When we set up a shelter, we make sure that people are fed, that they have a safe place to go. We make sure that we have some nursing support at the shelter. We make sure that we have some mental health support at the shelter. We can also do this feeding mental health health services in the field as well. And so we often are going out into the field and interacting with people. With mental health, I like to refer to it as mental health first aid. So we're not getting into past lives or sitting people down on couches. But the nature of disasters is that they are very, very stressful events. And whether someone has a pre-existing condition that is exacerbated by the disaster, or they've just seen their entire lives disappear in front of them with when their house burns or the flood has taken away their home, our mental health professionals donate their time to try to address some of these concerns. If there's any
lingering issues, then a referral is made to a local mental health provider.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I apologize for interrupting here, but I just didn't want to forget to thank you on behalf of our, in our fire department. We had a house fire recently, and the woman lost the home and her three pets inside of it, and the Red Cross came right away. We're still mopping up and put her up in a motel and got her other services, but had her housed by that evening. Mm-hmm. And we really appreciate your service, and the TIP team, the trauma intervention team, was called, and just it just went together like that.
Fantastic.
Thank you very much.
That's wonderful.
And we are very, very dependent upon volunteers to do what we do. In my office, I have 7 paid staff and about 680 volunteers. And the chapter, as the map that I had intended to project, did not project, the Oregon Trail chapter that I primarily serve covers all of northwestern Oregon. So I like to say I can go one way for year-round surfing and the other way for year-round skiing. So that includes Yamhill, Columbia, Clatsop, Clackamas, Washington, Multnomah, and Tillamook counties. And so we have volunteers throughout our counties. We spend a lot of time training these volunteers, making sure that we have the systems in place to respond 24 hours a day, whether it's the single family fire or the small emergency or whether it's the bigger emergency.
David, how rapidly could you respond if there was an earthquake in southern Oregon and a tsunami in the Gold Beach or Brookings area?
Well, very, very rapidly. And as I mentioned, we have volunteers throughout the state who we, again, train. We also put a lot of effort into pre-positioning supplies near these volunteers, knowing that the geography of Oregon is conducive to isolating areas during times of disaster, like we saw with the Tillamook floods. So anyway, we make sure, and we not only make sure that we have the facilities, but we also make sure that we have the local partnerships.
Tell me again, what is your position with the American Red Cross?
I'm the Emergency Services Director for the Oregon Trail Chapter.
Okay. How familiar are you with the coast?
I'm pretty familiar with the northern coast.
Okay. Coos Bay down to Brookings.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with that area? South of Coos Bay?
Yes, I've certainly been through there.
Okay.
So we do take the threats that Oregon faces very, very seriously. And what we do is, as far as training in areas that we respond in, we not only do the sheltering, the feeding, the mental health services, the health services, but we also have a family assistance relief program where we meet one-on-one with each family based on their disaster cause needs that we do our best to verify. We then have an assistance program where we're trying to address those real emergency needs that are not covered by other sources like insurance. So this may mean...
a hero. All right.
This may mean that we put a family up after a single family fire in a motel for a few days, and it gives them a chance to assess where they are, to tap into other sources of assistance, depending on what they've lost. And we do this on a case-by-case basis. We will interview the family. Often we make sure that they have a place to stay, that they have food, if they've lost medications or durable medical equipment. We have some really crack nurses, or I should say really, really good nurses, is what my intent there, who are very good at working with pharmacies and doctors to get those medications replaced.
And if there's a need for critical household furnishings, then we'll assess on a case-by-case what those may be. And if we can't provide the assistance, we do a lot of referrals to other agencies that may make that type of assistance, which is a need.
Electronic medical records would be a great help, wouldn't it? If people,
yes.
If you needed to know and people had been evacuated, because that would give you their whole record of what kind of pharmacists they used. And
mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, can you ask him a question?
When you
run into a case, for example, a fire or some disaster, family, and you discover in the course of your investigation of or your assessment of the family and their needs that there is something else going on there, a criminal activity or severe mental health issues, something like that, are you able to then somehow, I know you're required to report abuse and things like that, but would you be able to link them to services that could help them in the long run rather than just their short-term needs?
Yes, certainly impossible. As I said, we work with a lot of different other agencies, whether nonprofits, governmental, sometimes for-profit businesses, doing a lot of information referral. And that's partially why we have mental health professionals as part of our volunteer force, as well as nurses who can make that assessment. If our initial responders see that there's a unique need there, we'll do our very best to hook them up with the assistance that they need.
Thank you.
So, as I said, we partner with a lot of different agencies, from other nonprofits. For example, the Southern Baptists are a great partner for us when it comes to the bigger disasters, because they do a fantastic job of feeding the masses. And so there's a Southern Baptist entity which is based in the Portland-Vancouver area, which we often work with. Businesses, for example, Intel, may come forward during the larger disasters and offer up their employees to help us out. There's actually, I believe it's 1995 legislation passed by Oregon that is the state disaster leave law, which is permissive legislation and allows agencies from the state, city, county levels to release their employees for a defined limit. I believe it's 2 weeks to help out the Red Cross. In the really big disasters where there's been a state declaration and perhaps even a federal declaration, then we might work very closely with the military. So, to give you an example of what we do, and this is also a good opportunity to mention that we do a lot of community disaster education, and one of our missions is to reach out to the citizens of Oregon and try to make them the best prepared citizens in the entire U.S. And so a number of agencies, the Red Cross, a number of Red Cross chapters have collaborated to put together this brochure. The goal was to consolidate a lot of information into one place. We work with public utilities. We've worked with a lot of state agencies so that our citizens can have a resource and reference to help their families prepare for whatever may come. With the flood response of November 2006, most of our activity was seen in eastern Clackamas County, the Depot Bay, Newport areas, and Tillamook, especially the city of Tillamook, although we did see some activity in the northern part of Tillamook County as well. And we knew that this storm was coming in, so we did take proactive steps to not only coordinate with local emergency management to get their assessment of what was might happen, as well as the National Weather Service, to get an idea of where they saw the rivers going. But we also were very proactive in ensuring that any shelter activity in the city of Tillamook was supported, knowing that from our past experience that the city of Tillamook and other areas in Tillamook County often get isolated due to flood events. And then there was also a little bit of activity in Polk County, as well as a shelter was actually opened up in, I believe it was Hood River County, although no one showed up. So what we ended up doing, and most of our activity involved reaching out to the people in the field, both in Tillamook counties, Clackamas counties, and Lincoln County, and not only assessing what their needs were, but handing out what we call bulk supplies. And this is everything from cleaning supplies to gloves to shovels. We did set up two shelters. The one in Tillamook ended up seeing 24 people. The Tillamook County Fairgrounds made an excellent location for us because we were also able to set up a place where people could come to get our assistance, and we did that in an adjacent building. And then we served a lot of meals, not only at the shelter, but also out in the field. In Clackamas County, we distributed, we distributed a fair number of bulk items, although most of the people there were very gracious and said thanks, but no thanks. And so some of the typical things we distribute include these cleaning supplies, comfort kits, which are personal toiletry kits, and then miscellaneous bulk distribution items. So we ended up assisting 60 families statewide, and most of those were in the Tillamook area. With Hurricane Katrina and Rita response, as people may recall, that Hurricane Katrina initially rolled over Florida and then went out to sea. Well, the immediate impact just from Florida was a surge in calls to every Red Cross chapter. And the citizens of the state called about everything from donating money and kind goods to wanting to volunteer and go to Florida when Katrina actually impacted Louisiana and Mississippi and the other states. People wanted to get on a plane the next day and go on and help. So we've never seen such an influx of goodwill locally before, which created quite a few challenges for us. We also had people who were calling about their loved ones to find out what might have happened to them. We do run a national welfare inquiry registry, which is web-based. And once news of the massive evacuations, whether assisted or on people's own volition, hit the news, people really opened up their doors all over the place to say, if anyone makes it up here, I can try to help, I can house them for X number of days or months or assist the families. And then we also got a lot of questions revolving around the need for blood. And so as a chapter, we really got overwhelmed by the surge in phone calls. We actually took down our phone system initially, and then we got it back up, and we got some assistance in making our system more robust. But we actually had this phone bank going for about 2 weeks. And then the word came, and I remember very distinctly, because it was on a Friday going into Labor Day weekend, that FEMA was tinkering with the idea of flying 1,000 evacuees up to Portland. And this created quite a few challenges for us. Luckily, the Portland Public Schools stepped forward about 11:30 in the evening to say, we have Washington Monroe High School. Well, we haven't used it in quite a few years as a high school. It's yours. So we had a great partnership with Portland Public Schools. They put in a lot of work to retrofit, or I should say rehab, the mothballed facility. and we put our volunteers to work. And so in the course of about 2 days, we were prepared to shelter 1,000 people. We also had an overflow shelter in Oregon City just in case that was needed. However, FEMA then decided not to send people en masse. However, we had about 965 families that made it up here and sought Red Cross assistance through their own volition. So we turned the same facility into a multi-agency assistance center. We had a lot of nonprofits represented there. We had some state agencies like the Oregon Employment Agency represented. We had the U.S. Postal Office. We had some bureaus from the city of Portland. We also had the Multnomah County Medical Reserve Corps very active in partnering with us. And they actually set up a little medical intake clinic in which our nurses and mental health providers partnered with them. They actually saw a fair amount of business, and it was a wonderful partnership.
David, if 1,000 people, though, I'm sure did make you feel overwhelmed, mm-hmm. But in a major disaster like an earthquake on the fault line, you would be seeing 10,000.
Absolutely.
And so have you given a lot of thought to that since this issue has come up?
We have. And we are actually right now working very closely with the, initially the plan is the city of Portland and then rolling out to adjacent regions to work on an evacuation plan. We're actively talking with them about how we can shelter tens of thousands of people.
Right.
And we're actively pursuing a relationship with Metro so that we can use the convention center and the expo center. Unfortunately, Portland has very, very few mega facilities to house tens of thousands of people. So the ultimate solution will be a partnership between the Red Cross, other local agencies, for such a huge disaster as this, certainly the military.
Well, if you remember in Katrina, they were sent to the Superdome, but they had no facilities there. They had no way of taking care of them, sustainable way to take care of them. And they used the airport for the hospital. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there were 10,000 people at the airport, all injured. And they flew doctors in, some from Oregon. Mm-hmm. And we have one doctor that continues to go back and forth to New Orleans. And yesterday, or today, this morning, they had tornadoes. So if you were living in a FEMA trailer, your FEMA trailer was damaged. So you have to feel like if you are in those conditions that you have a little black cloud over your head. It's really very, very sad what they've been going through. I'm going to have to ask you to close, give you about 5 more minutes.
Okay.
We have to be out of this room.
Okay. So I'll speed along. As I mentioned before, we had a tremendous number of people who wanted to help in the hurricane-impacted areas. So we stood up a very, very large training program, actually at the high school as well. And actually being a high school and educational facility, it actually worked very well. Mm-hmm. We ended up deploying 330 people just out of the Portland area, and that doesn't count the other chapters within the state of Oregon. And then, being that we had a large auditorium at the high school, we also hosted the Governor's Oregon Disaster Preparedness Summit, which is a bringing together of a lot of emergency management, elected officials, the governor, to talk about the state of preparedness within Oregon.
That went well?
Yeah, I think it went well.
Okay.
And then the numbers for us locally were huge compared to what we normally do in a local year. You can see some of the numbers there. And the training experiences, we had 1,549 separate people trained, but some of those people went through multiple classes, and so we approached 4,000 training experiences. And then the people who actually sought Red Cross assistance, families numbered 530, 964. total. We operated this facility under the Red Cross management for a little over a month, and then we turned it over to Multnomah County that continued limited services there for the next 4 or 5 months. That's it. Any questions?
Any questions of Reuben? Representative Krieger?
Madam Chair, it seems like whenever there's a disaster worldwide, our country sends massive amount of aid to all kinds of things. What kind of aid came from other parts of the world for these types of things, with Katrina specifically? From outside, I was from France.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of specific examples. The advantage of being the part of the International Red Cross movement is that there are Red Crescent societies all over the world who we have both bilateral relationships with, and I do know that we got some specific assistance. I believe, for example, the Kuwaiti society gave us a large amount of money to further the disaster preparedness capability in the typically hurricane-impacted states. And certainly when other regions of the world have large disasters, we'll either talk with them on a bilateral basis or work through our international movement to see how we can assist.
Just brief, I know how we assist, but I just wonder, you wonder, it doesn't matter where it is in the world, we go as a country. I mean, where was France, where was Germany, where was England, where was Czechoslovakia, and all those that we would help, Turkey during earthquakes. Those people actually send services or doctors like we do?
Mm-hmm. And actually, the Canadian Red Cross has been a great partner with us, not just for Hurricane Katrina, but for past very, very large mega disasters.
All right. Other questions? Senator George?
Oregon Pacific Chapter. Where's that based? I see it's a 541 number.
Mm-hmm. It's based out of Eugene.
It is Eugene.
And it also has service centers in, let's see if I can get them all right, Newport, Coos Bay, Roseburg, and Albany.
Right. Okay. Thanks.
All right. Well, we better get out of the room so they can get it all cleaned up and ready for the next
bunch. Thank
you very much. So if there's no other business to come before this body, I'll call the meeting adjourned. Thank you, David, very much.